She'll give you a sign.
Somebody give me a sign? We good? My name is Jack and I'm an addict. Grateful to be clean, grateful to be in another gathering of Narcotics Anonymous. I am overjoyed to be participating in an event that visits the history of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, when I was first asked to participate, you know, one of my friends that's been clean for a while, I'm gonna take my clothes off. Anyway, I can feel the spirit. It's getting real warm in here.
Woo!
Yeah. Anyway, he asked me to come to speak at this little thing they had going on over there in Fresno. And it wasn't very well attended, but it was very sweet, and the people that were there seemed to enjoy it, and I certainly did. So let me just start by saying that I'm going to visit real briefly a couple of the dates that were mentioned earlier by other folks. And these first few numbers and statements are extracted from some of the literature that we viewed earlier here today. Stop looking at me like that. Anyway, so if I'm wrong, I'm sure everybody can correct me, but I'm going to try to go for it anyway. Now, I've never done this. I've never spoken off a paper at an NA anything, so bear with me. And I'm going to run through this, and then I'm going to tell you what it was really about. Okay, so in 1971, we had the first World Conference. It was held at the La Mirada Country Club in Southern California.
Convention.
They refer to it as a conference, it's interesting. In 1976, there were 200, quote unquote, regular meetings documented in the World's Directory. In 1977, in April, I got misdirected to my first 12-step meeting, which was Alcoholics Anonymous, by a phone number that was handwritten on the back of the little white book that I had received as a response to a program that was up in Portland, Oregon. It was an assault therapy program that was taking court-mandated drug addicts who were convicted of multiple offenses, which my ex-husband, a guy named John, had been court-mandated to for his umpteenth drug-related offense in lieu of 25 to life in the penitentiary. And when he got busted, we were living in a Christian faith healers compound in Ashland, Oregon. And I was, quote unquote, the mother of a baby boy that I had been so screwed up that I didn't even know I was pregnant. And so here I was with this habit that I had had since I was about 17 years old that I couldn't keep and I couldn't get rid of. And I had this baby that I could not get unemployment or welfare for because I had done fraud between two states. And I had no rescuers. And so I had ended up down near Fresno in a farming town called Fireball, which is about 48 miles west of Fresno, living on the graces of my ex-husband's parents, who my son was their only grandchild, and that was the only reason they even let me in their house. And when I got to their house, they had said, you know, you can go down the street and drink at one of those seven bars, or you can take a drawer full of these pills right here, and you can go into this room that we've doctored up like a bar, and you can have some drinks. Just don't shoot that heroin. And you know, I stole everything. I didn't think they'd notice missing right away, and I sold it to the secondhand guy in town who they'd known for 30 years, right? And I was insane. But what happened to me was somewhere in that, like, I can't stand myself anymore, I had written to that place up in Oregon, and they sent me that little white book. And what happened to me was I started reading it, and I would get to the second story, and this guy was talking about the third step. Now, you have to understand that I had no literary context for any of the stuff that I had read. But what happened to me was that I would be sitting there in my drug withdrawal miasma, and I would be reading this book, and I would get to this story, and it would talk about turning one's life and will over to the care of a loving God. And I'd want to puke, because the image that I would get was like a cartoon Buddha with a keep on trucking guy in a parade coming out of his belly button saying, "Yes, sir, Jesus." Now, I don't know about you guys, but I was not a Jesus person. You know, I was from the other side of the tracks. And but I kept finding myself reading that book over and over again and coming to that place and feeling like I'd want to puke and throwing the book down. And I was watching this commercial. I had my baby there. That I would look at my baby, and I couldn't tell if I could feel anything or not. And I'd be watching the soap commercials on TV, and I would be crying my ass off watching these moms and these babies in these commercials, right? And I flipped the book over, and there was a handwritten phone number on the back. And I called that phone number. And there was a young girl who answered it. And she said, "Well, you know, you're probably trying to get a hold of my dad, but he's not here right now. They went to Bakersfield for an AA roundup, but there's a meeting down here if you come over here." And she gave me an address. So I had my last $20 bill in my pocket that I, you know, before I did something else illegal, it was like my last 20 bucks. And I told the folks that I was going to go to this meeting, and I left my son with them. And I got in this little rattletrap car I had, and I drove through the Thule fog. And I was so fucked up that I didn't realize that Fresno was like really flat, and like most of the streets run east and west or north and south. And so I didn't know that the 99 was kind of like the highway that ran from end to end of the state, and that everything kind of diverged off of there. And so in my little thing where they told me to go, it was off of this one street. And I went to this thing called an Alano Club, which I had no idea what that fucking was. And so my idea was I was going to go to the Connections House first, and then I would go to the meeting. But to go to the Connections House, I had to go to the next street down. I didn't know that when I went to the next street down, it was like a major Belmont, which is like a major east-west thing. And I went out there to the Connections House, and he wasn't home, so I went all the way back to the freeway. And I drove up the one block to Olive Avenue, where the Alano Club was. And it took me 28 days of being clean to realize that they were only four blocks apart. Now, I'm saying that because, you know, I want you to get it, because there's going to be other stuff I'm going to talk about that you're going to be amazed that I'm standing here at all. So I want you to know that the first time that I heard that what I had was a disease was in one of those meetings. And I don't know about you, but I kind of got it. I went and I kept relapsing. I never drank another thing of alcohol. In that first meeting, I heard the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking, and I thought, I can make that shit up right now. But I want you to know that when they sent me that little white book, they had also sent me a packet full of AA shit, which I had immediately shit-canned because I wasn't one of those. So, I'm sure this isn't the way I'm supposed to be sharing, but fuck it, it's what I'm doing. I have to believe that God is doing more of this than I am. I'm just willing to share whatever, right? That's the way I do it. I don't know how you do it. This is the way I do it. So I never drank another thing of alcohol again. And I heard that the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. And I thought I could do that. And then I heard that it was principles before personalities. Now, you have to understand that I'm one of those addicts that I really didn't want to be a fucking addict, you know? And I did cold turkey detox a number of times on my own. I completely removed myself from the geography I was in and took myself to another completely different geography, hoping that somehow if I had changed my outsides, that my insides would get different along the way. I also went and like there was a time when I thought that if I went back to my biological father and I threw myself down in front of him and I confessed all my fucking sins, that maybe I wouldn't have to end up in those places doing that shit with those people ever again. And what happened was he took one look at me, I was 22 years old. He said, you know, Jackie, if you didn't think like that, if you didn't feel like that, if you didn't hang out with those people, if you didn't act like that, if you didn't do those things, then you wouldn't end up in those places. But duh. So I skanked back off. Anyway, flow ahead. So I'm doing these AA meetings in Fresno at the Alano Club. They happen in the daytime, they happen at nighttime, they happen in the morning. And they wrote to the General Service Office to figure out if they could throw me out. And what was reported back to me, nobody ever treated me crap into my face. But what happened was I got in there one day, and this girl who was still using Valium said, do you think the problem I'm having trouble with relapses because I'm using Valium? And I said, and somebody jumped up and says, you can't tell her what to do, you're not a doctor. Okay. She died. Okay, well, I'm trying to bring it back around. I'm really trying really hard here. So anyway, the thing is that I would go to the noon meeting and I would be in the spirit and I'd be feeling it and I would see the gold light floating around the heads and I would know who was going to get called on next because I was psychotic, but I was always right. And then one day another addict showed up and we looked at each other and she said, I got the money, and I said, I got the car and I know where it's at. And we'd go do it, and then I'd run back because I didn't understand what was happening to me. And then some of that stuff in that literature that did talk to me said that sometimes that we have this, you know, blank space in our head. Whether, you know, with all the information in the universe, they will still make that choice. It talked about this being a disease, a compulsion, an obsession, and a spiritual void. And it spoke to me. I had read inspirational books. I had traveled all over I'd been to Giant Rock for the Flying Saucer people. I had been to Mount Shasta for Saint Germain. I had like done all these treks and pilgrimages trying to figure out the mechanics of God. Numerology, iridology, spontaneology, you know, every kind of ology I could get my hands on, trying to, if I could just get good, then maybe I wouldn't have to end up in the places I ended up, which for me was puking pill salads on strangers, thousands of miles from home, and ERs where nobody would have claimed me even if I had had a driver's license. The last time I had seen my dad using, he picked me up, took me down to the bus station, gave me a one-way ticket out of town, told me never to come back and don't call either. I was 22 years old. There's a whole lot of shit I'm not going to talk about. If you want to hear about it, you can call me later. I'm going to try to get to back what we're doing here. That's just to let you know where I started. So, believe me, I had no college education, I didn't have a driver's license, I didn't have any family, I had no place to live, I didn't know how to do services, I couldn't have written a check. Well, I tried to write one time, and they had to correct me about four times that I was drunk. Anyway, so in April, I got introduced to my very first 12-step meeting. Oh, the first miracle for me was that, remember I went to the Connections, but he wasn't home? I had my last $20 bill in my pocket. I went to that meeting. Drove all the way back out to Fireball, took my clothes off, and realized I still had a $20 bill in my pocket. That was the first miracle for me. So what happened was that after my relapse, which occurred on November 3rd of 1977, my ex-husband, who was in court mandate up in Portland, Oregon, got his first call. He'd been clean for 13 months. That was a miracle. And he called me. And I wasn't going to tell him that I was fucked up. But I was fucked up. And he put the director of the program on my phone, and she said, you got 2 days to get here, die loaded bitch. I instantly decided that it was God's will for me to go there. And in the process, I had had a dog that I'd been dragging around all over the world with me for about 10 years. They said I could bring him with me. I had made a spot for him in my car, and he ran off at the last moment. And I spent about an hour and a half running around Fresno trying to find that dog, and the demons were on me, and they were saying, you know, if you don't get out of here now, you're not going to get out of here at all. And I got in the car, and that was hard for me. I mean, the biggest emotional connection I'd ever had was with that animal, right? And it was like I had to leave him to go. And when I got up to, they had their core house was in Portland, and they're half kind of stepping towards Back Society. It was in Medford, Oregon. And so the deal was I was supposed to drive to the house in Medford. They were going to ship John out of the one in Portland to Medford, simultaneously ship me up to. And what happened for me was that I was the only person in that program who had not been court mandated. I was the only person in that program who had been to a 12-step meeting of any kind, not in the context of that program. So what that did was it put me in a position to be aware of how different that was, treatment, from recovery. What did happen for me too was I was restricted. I couldn't have any personal phone calls. I couldn't talk to anybody. I couldn't look out the window. I couldn't watch TV. I couldn't read a magazine. In fact, I couldn't even look in the fireplace when they had the fire going unless I got permission from somebody to do it. They decided I wasn't an addict because I got there. I had some money in my pocket. I had the car. And my ex-husband said, well, she's not. I'm not. And God knows I am. And my tracks are worse than his anyway. I still have them. If you want to see them, I can show you. I'm trying to go as fast as I can here. So what happened was I got there. And, you know, physically, honestly, that's where my clean date begins. So as of yesterday, I have 38 years clean. I hope this is at least entertaining you, right? Okay. So, Medford. What happened was he had to, eventually they decided they needed to throw me out there. I was some kind of a threat to management. And so I ended up being the longest term person sitting on the bench without court restraint. Everybody else who ran away from there would get 15 in addition to whatever their sentence was. I didn't have one. I saw myself as kind of like, if I'm not doing this, if I'm not modeling recovery in some fashion, these people may never see it. And I tell you what, in that 38 years that I've been clean, I cannot even begin to tell you how important it has been for me personally to try to have integrity no matter what the fuck's flying or how big the rewards are that I'm getting or not getting. You know, if I don't get the husband, if I don't get to keep the house, if the car isn't working, if I, you know, save all my money and something comes up all of a sudden to spend it on, it's not what I wanted to do for fun. You know, it's like to me, recovery is something that doesn't have, I'm getting the chills really good right now. Thank you, Jesus. I got my mind. Jesus. Whoever, Buddha, Bozo, I don't think God gives a crap what you call him. Just call him something. Anyway, so, yeah. So what happens is, I don't take direction from the director. I take direction from my spirit. And they had put both houses together and sent them to Ocean Shores. And I was not supposed to look or talk to my ex-husband. And I wasn't supposed to look at my baby who was there in treatment with my ex-husband. And I managed to avoid the ex-husband, but I couldn't keep my eyes off the baby. And I got grouped. And I got told, they put it on my ex-husband to tell me I had to leave. And if he didn't, he was going to go back to the joint. So he agreed to kick me out. And now, what she didn't know was I was already breaking up razor blades and putting them in my pajama pocket because my plan was I was going to swallow those razor blades if I couldn't get it right. And these people were not equipped. They didn't have any training. They weren't counselors. They were just taking advantage of people like us. And so what happened was they told me that I could have a one-way ticket to any place I wanted to go. And I chose Reno because I could imagine myself drinking beer only on the weekends and being a change girl. Like, that was my very best hope for my life. So I was sitting in the Portland bus station. I had my one-way ticket to Reno and a four-hour wait. I had $2.50 in change left in my pocket. I had this weird haircut they made me get. I was wearing a dress, and I never wore dresses. I had underwear on. I never wore underwear. I had all my shit in boxes, the ex-husband, the baby, and the car, and I lost my dog to go to this place. And I was sitting there, and I was watching. It was like right after the Christmas holiday, New Year holiday. All the regulars were coming in the Portland bus station. It was cold. It was rainy. It was dark. I was sitting there watching these people. And I kept thinking they were my people. And one minute I would be in like this psychotic kind of like, I can't believe, you know, that I'm here. And like, I can't ever get anything right. And I'm such a piece of shit that I can't fucking do it. And I'm sitting there, and I'm watching those regulars, and 1 minute it's a comedy show, the next minute it's a fucking tragedy in my head. And this bolt of lightning runs through my head, and it says, there are no arbitrators. What the fuck does that mean? Well, to me, what it meant was the director of that fucking treatment program, my father, or anyone else on the planet, was not capable of making a decision. I was the only one that could make the decision. And I made the decision in that moment that I was gonna be clean no matter fucking what, and I was gonna die clean no matter fucking what. Somehow, I managed to get a collect phone call in to a public phone in the Alano Club. And the one of, like, there was 200 or 300 people going to meetings there, there was one guy who answered that phone, took the collect call, which he wasn't supposed to do. He told me, you change that ticket into Fresno when you come home. I didn't realize until I was on the bus going home that I had no reason to think of Fresno as home at that point. But a few weeks later, my ex-husband called me from jail. And he said, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do what they wanted. I have to go back in front of the judge, just as if I had done a parole violation. I'm doing, looking at 25 to life. Will you come up here and sit in court with me? So I left the baby with the grandparents in Fireball, and I went up to Medford, Oregon. I went to court. The court liaison for the house, who normally tells them, cut them loose, is saying, lock them up. The guy, the DA, who normally says, lock them up, is saying, cut them loose, we'll find them. We ended up sitting in a hotel room in Medford, Oregon, looking at each other like strangers because we'd never been together clean. And my decision was that I was going to try to make an amends to him no matter what the fuck he did. And he did a lot of fucking that year. No matter what the fuck he did, that I was going to try to provide a clean household for him to be safe in. And that I was going to be safe too. And I already knew that if I was going to stay clean, I needed Narcotics Anonymous. There was another phone number in that book that belonged to Jimmy Cannon. And Jimmy Cannon became my lifeline from about 1,000 miles away. And we had a conversation once a week. I paid for the phone call. I did do that. In 1978, my ex-husband, a guy named Jim D, who may still be alive, so I won't say his full name, and myself started the first Narcotics Anonymous meeting in Medford, Oregon, and it was held at the police station right next to the police chief's office. Wondered why those people didn't come. Yeah. But, and I'm sure that there was all kinds of tradition violations all over the motherfucking place. But, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do. So in the context of that, what happened was that there was a woman who had been one of my rescuers who had a bookstore in Ashland, Oregon, which is just kind of over the border when you first get into Oregon. And I had known her for years. She had been a one-time member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got clean this time and I came back and I was serious, she said, hey, you know, there's a guy named Gene Haig who lives down over here in and you know, he's been involved in Narcotics Anonymous at times. He's kind of a renegade from Pacoima, and he's got another friend, and blah, blah, blah. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm gonna go meet this motherfucker. And so I met Gene. Gene, crazier than shit, man. And he was always jumping on like the next thing. Like the next thing that was gonna save the world. And he had all the right energy. He had a crazy wife too. Anyway, so what happened was that when the World Convention moved to Texas, that left a big void in California for that convention. And there were these three people in Portland who decided that what they really needed to do was to have a regional convention. And they called it the Pacific Northwest Regional Convention for Narcotics Anonymous. It is still the oldest ongoing regional convention in the world. So what happened was we went to this convention, and I was like, I was having these visions of these addicts getting in their car and being like little tiny beacons of light, and they were all gonna converge at this hotel in Portland, Oregon, and together they were gonna light up the world, man. And I was always hallucinating shit like that, but you know what, it happened. And the next thing I knew is Gene comes to me and he says, I got the bid for the next Pacific Pacific Northwest Regional Convention. It's going to be in Ashland, Oregon. And I'm going, oh, holy shit. Yeah, okay. And so we started having these little intergroup things. So there was me and Pepe, my ex-husband. Sometimes he didn't like Gene too good. And then there was this Jim Duck guy. He didn't like Gene either. And then there was these two gay women that lived down someplace in the middle of the forest in Northern California. And so, like, we would come together once a month, and we would have these, like, we called them the intergroup meetings, kind of. Basically, we ate a lot of food. Tilly made most of it. And we talk a lot of, like, recovery stuff. And this guy, Pepe, became my first sponsor. Ooh, it was a man, yeah. Well, I don't know about you, but, you know, where I grew up in Narcotics Anonymous, there really wasn't any women. And Pepe had what I wanted. And I don't mean his money, his house, his car, his sexual prowess, or whatever like that. What I'm talking about was I met this guy who, in recovery, had discovered that his two children were suffering from Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, which typically is fatal before adulthood, and that him and his wife had opted to take them to this place near Redding, California, so they can home care for them with their own hands. And this was a guy who had a spirit that, for me, it was like, if I could walk through my life, no matter what the fuck happens, and I could have that kind of a spirit, I'm good. And I have to tell you that I do not own a home. I do not have a fancy car. I do not have a lot of gold jewelry. I do not have a romantic relationship that has endured any time. What I have is an amazing life. So for the second regional convention, I drew up the flyers. I'm saying I because I did. So if you think this is an ego trip, you know, check it off your list. Yeah, she's a bitch, she's an egomaniac. But I did all the fucking work, and I'm happy I did. So what happened was, there was me and Gene from Oregon, and about 680 people from California, and a few from Portland that showed up. And I was amazed. It was like we had this little party and they all came. Now, just to let you know that what was happening in my personal life was that I was working in a sawmill, which was my first legitimate job in my whole life. I found out I was pregnant and I had my second baby, and my husband was absolutely not in love with me. He fell in love with his second ex-wife the day before I had my child. This all occurred, the convention happened in October, and I didn't celebrate my 2 years clean until the first weekend in November that year. So that convention, that work, that every week that I went to Gene's house, and I went up in this little attic thing, and I did all that, you know, I mailed out all the, I confirmed everybody's registration, that I drew all the flyers, that I invited the speakers, that, you know, yes, I did. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing, but I did it. And I prayed that people would come, and they did come. And when I was there, you know, I met Bob and Sydney Raymar, and, you know, there's a whole other pathway with that I could go in, but right now I'm just going to talk about that what they did for me that day was that the convention was over, and I was a fucking mess, man. In my personal life, I had no idea how to decide what my next footsteps should be. And so the two of them and these three other ladies who ended up staying an extra day, who are all professional KDAC type people, they grouped me for 8 hours. And they helped me sort out like what I need. They didn't tell me what to do, they helped me sort out what I needed to do. And so my big decision was that I was gonna go back to my ex-husband and tell him, I'm willing to try to work this with you if you can make a commitment to the family, and even if I think it's a lie. I'm willing to work with that little. And he started to lie, and he caught himself, and he said, I can't fucking do it. And so what happened for me was that I surrendered. I felt like I had been standing in a conduit of shit that had been trying to blow through me, and I'd been holding onto the walls of the tunnel, trying to hold the shit back, and when I let go, people showed up to pack my stuff. The lady who owned the house I was renting showed up and bought all the big furniture, so I had road dog money. The woman who had been the main speaker for that convention invited me to her house to work on some inventory process. I didn't know where I was going to end up. I didn't know what I was going to do. And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of formal prayer in my vernacular at that point. I hadn't been clean 2 years yet. But I got in my car, and, you know, like, the snow melted off of Mount Ashland, and, you know, it cleared the way. And I had my little Roundup Trap Pinto station wagon and those two babies. And I headed south, and I had no idea where it's gonna end up. I ended up back in Fresno. And what happened for me there was I got there. Oh, so Gene had a cousin that had an airplane. And so we were gonna go from our convention to the first Northern California Regional Convention in the airplane. And then the weather got shitty. So I didn't get to go. I felt really deprived. But so the next thing was the Southern California Having Convention. Okay, I gotta wrap it up. Okay. Let me just say, I'm gonna hit these high spots and then I'll shut the fuck up. Okay, so in 1980, I started the first meeting in Fresno. We now have 100 and something. Somebody help me. How many meetings do we have in Fresno a week now? Are you asleep? Well, somebody knows how many, but let's say there's at least 7 a day, I think. And there's more meetings in the outer, it all kind of rippled out. Okay, in 1982, Gene called me and he asked me to go speak at a gathering of NA that was being held in the in Whitehorse, Canada, because he had to go to his daughter's thing. And I met a whole bunch of people. And I ended up inviting them to come participate in a convention, which I had put a bid on. The 4th Northern California Regional Convention had been held in Santa Cruz that year, and sitting there listening to people with mega clean time, like 4 years, share, it hit me that we ought to have that convention in Fresno. Now, you have to understand, we had no answering service, we had no area service committee, we had no phone line. In fact, we didn't even have we had a little card that had 3 meetings on it. The other people who participated in putting that convention together, none of them even had a year clean at the time that we started working on that. We had the largest single gathering of Narcotics Anonymous that had ever been held anywhere in the world. There was over 1,250 people who registered for that convention, and there was a meeting of the World Service Literature Committee a couple of days at the same hotel prior. In 1985, there were 29 registered meetings in Northern California. In 1986, there were 27 meetings a week in Fresno. In 1989, the Fresno and the outlying areas put together their regional composite. And in 1990, I had the privilege of chairing our first regional convention. What I hear from people who come through Fresno is that it's one of the warmest fellowships they get to visit.
You know it.
Okay, Doc. Anyway, thanks for listening to me. I really enjoyed myself, and I hope you enjoyed some of that. Anyway.
Here's the top. Here's the top. Here's the top.